Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Mike Scaletti. Today I'm joined by
Major C.C. Bernstein.
Today we're going to talk about U.S. v. Suarez. This is a fascinating case from Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces, talking about UCI and some interesting, complex legal issues. Why don't you give us a rundown?
Well, the appellant, Corporal Suarez of the U.S. Marine Corps, pled guilty to several drug offenses, including the use, introduction, distribution of cocaine, and conspiracy to distribute cocaine. In exchange for his guilty plea, one specification of solicitation to distribute cocaine and one specification of attempted prostitution were dismissed. He was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge, 60 months of total confinement, and reduction to E1.
But the real story of this case starts with the facts of the UCI motion, which it gets really interesting because it's a perfect case to use to brief commanders about, because the sergeant major and the battalion commander, and they're both Marines. We should start. This is a Marine case.
This is not an Army case.
This is not an Army case. Could be, but not. It's also great because I love using other services as examples for UCI. It warms my heart. The battalion commander and a sergeant major coordinated with NCIS to make an arrest within their formation of a guy who had been selling drugs, or they suspected of selling drugs. And then, so what did they do? Naturally, they had a company formation, brought him in front of the company formation, and then proceeded to call him all sorts of names. Drug kingpin, piece of crap, mixing in some nice words about him, and basically discouraging everyone from helping him out.
Exactly. About a week later, an IG investigation was opened against the command based on an anonymous complaint that included the apprehension of Corporal Suarez and the comments that were made during that apprehension. Before the investigation was even closed, the regimental commander replaced the battalion commander as the convening authority, apparently in an attempt to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest. Ultimately, the command leadership was found to have exercised poor judgment and were subsequently relieved of their positions. About a month later, charges against Corporal Suarez were referred to a general court-martial. The defense team filed a motion to dismiss all charges due to unlawful command influence, or UCI, as you said, sir, arguing that the leadership's public comments made it impossible for him to receive a fair trial.
Yep, so the military judge did do the burden shifting of the UCI. If you remember, in the process of UCI is to raise some evidence. And then if the military judge finds there's some evidence that could constitute UCI, they'll shift the burden to the government to try and prove whether it was actual UCI. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't actual UCI, or to prove that the UCI had no impact. Here, the military judge did find some evidence, shifted the burden, and then even though he determined that apparent UCI didn't take place and that the government had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't amount to actual UCI, he was concerned about apparent UCI, and we'll save the discussion, which I'm sure has happened on other podcasts, about whether apparent UCI still exists or not. But he was still concerned about that, so he ordered some additional remedies. Did you want to talk about those?
Sure, sir. So he ordered that the convening authority would issue a directive to encourage any member to serve as a witness without repercussion. So essentially took the authority figure and wanted them to articulate to the community that there was no consequence for supporting them. And in fact, a directive to encourage the community to come forward if they had any evidence that they wanted to present at the court-martial in support of the defendant. Secondly, the defense was authorized liberal voir dire of the members concerning whether they knew of the incident or anything about how members of the command viewed the appellant. So he widened the scope of voir dire so that the defense would have all of the information necessary to select the most impartial panel available.
Right. And then eventually that military judge is swapped out, right? And there was a second military judge also had some concerns, so issued a third remedy that he just said, hey, we're not going to have any members that come from this battalion. No members from 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Tell me what happens next that makes this a CAF case.
Well, sir, here's the twist. Those remedies were never implemented because before the case went to a full trial, Suarez entered into a plea agreement that contained a provision to waive all waivable motions. During the plea inquiry, the military judge specifically confirmed that Suarez understood he was giving up his right to appeal that UCI issue. And on the record, Suarez agreed.
Yeah, so this is where it gets even more complicated, because after the trial, both Suarez and his defense counsel submitted affidavits citing the defense counsel had incorrectly advised him that the UCI issue would be preserved, which is interesting. It gets into some IAC type issues. And then in addition to that, Suarez stated he wouldn't have pled guilty otherwise. And I don't know if you're going to get into this later or not, but he talks about how he misunderstood. Suarez said he misunderstood and was misadvised about the potential implications of sex offender registration.
Yes, sir. And we do get into that because that's one of the bases for the decision, right? Ultimately, what we know at this stage is that we've got the judge on the record properly advising Suarez. And then potentially behind the scenes during attorney-client confidential communications, maybe receiving different information. The question is, how does the court handle that if on appeal, the appellant says, during my confidential communications with my attorney, I was told something different than what the judge told me on the record. Which one prevails?
Why don't you give us a quick rundown of what the NMCCA did with this?
Yes, sir. So they were considering this question. They received the affidavit from the appellant and from his counsel that he had received advice that the waive all waivable motions provision would not prevent the appellate court from reviewing the UCI issue, and that he would not have pled guilty if he knew that the appellate court would not review the UCI issue based on that term of the plea agreement. The Navy Marine Court held that the UCI was waived by the terms of the plea agreement and by the colloquy with the judge, and that even if it had not been waived, the government had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the UCI did not materially prejudice appellant's rights. They found that TDS was deficient in negotiating that plea agreement and advising that the UCI was preserved, but that appellant had failed to show that he was prejudiced.
Okay, so now let's get into CAF's issues. So we had three granted issues. The first was, did unlawful command influence affect appellant's court-martial? The second was, trial defense counsel's deficient performance prejudicial? And third is, did appellant waive review of the question of whether unlawful influence affected his court-martial? Now, it's telling that the court added that third issue themselves. It signals that they wanted to address that waiver question head-on. So, how did CAF analyze these questions?
Well, sir, CAF started with the third issue, the one that they brought up, the waiver. The court held that Suarez did waive his right to appeal the UCI claim. They reasoned that even if his own lawyer gave him bad advice, the military judge's on-the-record explanation of the waiver was clear and correct. Since Suarez confirmed to the judge that he understood he was giving up the right, the waiver was considered knowing and voluntary. Because the issue was waived, the court declared the first issue, that being whether unlawful command influence affected the court-martial, to be moot. They could not review it because the issue was waived.
But without the UCI on the table, now we're dealing almost exclusively in IAC land. So the lower court here found that the counsel's performance was deficient, but it didn't prejudice Suarez.
Right. And CAF disagreed with the lower court's prejudice analysis. The Navy Marine Court of Criminal Appeals said there was nothing in the record. That's quote, nothing in the record to suggest Suarez would have insisted on going to trial if he'd been properly advised. CAF pointed out that was clearly erroneous. They highlighted the post-trial affidavits from both Suarez and his lawyer. Those were evidence. Both stated that the incorrect advice about preserving the UCI issue and avoiding sex offender registration were critical to the decision to plead guilty. CAF stated that the correct legal test for prejudice here is whether there is a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's errors, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. The NMCCA had used the wrong standard, and CAF found there was clear evidence to support Suarez's claims.
Okay, so what did CAF finally do then?
Because the NMCCA applied the wrong legal principles in its prejudice analysis, CAF set aside the lower court's decision. The case was sent back to them to conduct a new review on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, this time using the correct legal standard.
So, kicking the ball back down into the NMCCA. So what do you think are the key takeaways for the field on this, Cece?
Well, sir, for our government listeners, this case underscores the importance of a thorough and clear inquiry from the military judge when a plea agreement involves a waiver of motions. That inquiry was the reason the waiver itself was upheld, even in the face of bad advice from the defense. It insulated the plea on that front. And I say that that's for the government listeners because protecting the integrity of the court-martial is really a strong burden on the trial counsel. And more important than winning those convictions is making sure that everything is procedurally accurate. But given that we are at TJAGLIC, sir, I'm aware that your department does educate judges. So maybe you have a takeaway for the judges on that sense that my rank can't necessarily handle.
Oh, your rank can handle it. You're spot on. Judges, the big takeaway would be do those inquiries. I mean, I think that most judges are already doing this. You know, we remember from our practitioner time for sure that if you had to waive all waivable motions, there was a time where they didn't love those, but they still exist. They're out there. They're pretty commonplace. Judges will look defense counsel in the eye and be like, what motions are you thinking about right now? And then they'll say, have you talked about those motions with your client? And a lot of times it goes, you know, we don't really have any. It would be interesting to see in a case like this where they were like, we weren't thinking about any specific motion at the time we signed that, if it would have the same outcome. Because if we didn't have that colloquy, I'm not sure that CAF gets to the knowing and voluntary piece of this. So that's why it's really important for military judges to do these inquiries about those waivable motions provisions so that they can make sure that they only have to do this work one time.
And for our defense listeners, the lesson is clear. Know the law on waivers and be precise in your advice. Document that advice contemporaneously with giving it, because while the affidavits were crucial for Suarez here, the case is a cautionary tale. Erroneous advice about what a guilty plea waives can be grounds for an appeal and get a conviction overturned. And also building on making sure that you are prepared to answer those colloquy that the judges are going to ask and prepare your client to listen to the judge and answer honestly in the moment. I think too often we think a prepared client is someone who knows how to read the script and knows where we are in the script, but we need to be checking in with those clients in the moment and make sure that they are still on board with what's going on, given any new information that comes up during the actual trial, because a guilty plea is also still a trial.
Yes, absolutely. And another thing for defense, what I think of when I read this case, I think of senior defense counsel and regional defense counsel out there. This is where you can really be of use, because you want to be approachable so that the defense counsel know that they can come to you with questions like, hey, I'm not sure if like a conviction for prostitution might end up as a sex offender registration. Can you help me make sure that I'm on the right track here? If you're approachable, they'll bring that to you. Another thing that you can do as a senior defense counsel is make sure that you're having those morning conversations that are not super structured or stressful, but where you're just kind of shooting the breeze and talking about cases, where you give those counsel an opportunity to be like, hey, I was thinking about this case. and I wanted to know X, Y, or Z if that's a good idea. And am I advising this guy right? Because while you have a one-on-one client relationship, this doesn't have to be an isolated, lonely practice. We can share these burdens. And that's something I think that most military defense counsel do pretty well. I think this case is unique in the sense that you got like the textbook scenario of UCI, and then you got like the textbook scenario where a defense counsel is either afraid to ask or just charging in the wrong direction. So it's kind of a perfect storm, and these cases always bring about interesting case law.
Yes, sir. And we might even see some more detailed takeaways once the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals comes back with their new decision using the correct legal principles.
Yep. But at the very least, everybody out there in the field, whether you practice military justice or not, has a great fact pattern to train UCI for their command teams.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today on CAF Chats. Join us next time for another deep and penetrating discussion into military justice.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.